should I chase that guy away? No, just find me.
No, he can't. He can't order.
He can't order. That's it. I want to have that book. I want you to give me that book.
It's fantastically thick.
Yes.
I will. Yeah, I need to still. I haven't read the whole thing. I've read. It's kind of like an encyclopedia. Really well. I got into Vietnam, like, I don't want to sleep now.
This is so good.
So I don't know if that's today, maybe a little bit. Yeah, it's okay. I hope I can run this one. No, it's really, it's not a big deal. I've actually been reading the book.
Delicious.
I didn't get rid of the book last
time.
Okay.
Oh, it's fine. I just wait for the
grind
to
open. Okay, no, that's great.
That's about the loudest noise it is.
Like percussion.
Yes.
Okay. Ready and hot.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to grab the noise after the grinding, or the silence after the grinding, which is not exactly silence, to introduce you to Duncan, who you know already, both of you. Duncan is a lecturer at Visual Arts and Media Studies, and he's doing a second part of a two-part lecture on, well, this time it's on Pullman. That's close to Pullman. thanks so much. Sorry, can you all, guys, if you just have a listen out for your coffee, because they can't shut them off.
Hello, everyone. So I have to, just before I start, if you're a little lost, the last week's talk was The Good Man Philip and the Scoundrel Pullman, and this week is The Good Man Philip and the Scoundrel Pullman, just to confuse everyone. Last week I recommended some reading, so I'm going to do the same this week. Only one book this time. I'm going to cover all of this in the talk today. It's a, what, like 700 page book. N.T. Wright's The Resurrection of the Son of God. It's incredible. It's probably the best scholarly research on the resurrection to date. This is Nicholas Thomas Wright, Bishop of Durham. So, yeah. He has written a shorter book, which I would have titled Eschatology for Dummies, but he's titled Surprised by Hope. So, you can get that as well. So, as I discussed last week, Philip Pullman's retelling of the story of Jesus in his book The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ has some fairly important things to say, especially about the way that the original message of the Gospels has often been abused by the Christian church. Instead of focusing on what Jesus calls the more important issues, things like social justice and mercy, the church has sometimes used the Gospel as a technique for gaining power. But unfortunately, in his haste to critique the partial abuse of the Gospels by the church, Pullman ends up abusing the Gospels completely. He takes a fair amount of creative license, as I discussed last week, to change many of the details and the words of Jesus and even suggests that in the end what makes Jesus a good man is the fact that he, like Pullman, is an atheist. Quite a radical invention. I really can sympathize with Pullman's position. Pullman's Jesus, in his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane before his crucifixion, complains about the silence of God, and then confesses that he deems God irrelevant for life on planet Earth. The world is beautiful enough, he says, and he suggests that life itself is good enough. Adding God to the mix seems to Pullman to be a betrayal of reality in some way, a betrayal of the material world. In Pullman's cozy first world bubble, surrounded by the comfort of wealth and the British bureaucracy, why would he need spiritual fulfillment, a sense of real rather than fabricated meaning, and a vision of an integrated reality instead of a disintegrated reality? This is an idea that I've been exploring a little bit more in my academic work. It certainly seems easier to sit on a self-made throne and hurl criticisms at the church. Pullman deems God unnecessary the same way a literary critic would deem Pullman unnecessary. The work of Pullman is so beautiful, so profound, so remarkable, so why bother with the frustrating idea that his books, in fact, have an author? Pullman's technique for righting the wrongs of the church may be likened to treating a minor headache by using a guillotine to get rid of the problem altogether. Pullman's approach is, however, slightly more disturbing and wrong-headed than this analogy suggests. Pullman sees the headache in the church and solves it by cutting his own head off. Such is the nature of his intellectual suicide. As I hope to explain here, he does stand on the apparently safe ground of skepticism, but his particular brand of skepticism is about as helpful to the intellect as the provision of sand would be to a water shortage. Pullman's gospel tells the story of two brothers, a good man and a rabbi named Jesus, and his twin brother, a manipulative schemer who is nicknamed Christ. Here Pullman uses the name of Christ specifically to throw stones at the idea that the Jesus of the New Testament had any kind of divine calling or presence. And it is precisely here that Pullman's approach gets particularly shifty. He works so hard to avoid certain aspects of the life of the biblical Jesus that it's worth wondering, what's he trying to avoid or hide? So the main two issues that I want to tackle today are as follows. Firstly, I want to examine Pullman's claim that Jesus was only a man and not the Son of God. And secondly, I want to look at Pullman's insistence that it is only through an imaginative process that the historical Jesus was turned into a kind of mythical figure that performed miracles and rose from the dead. So really small issues, I'm just going to cover them. Before I get to these, I just want to give you a little bit of a disclaimer. I can't pretend that I'm going to cover these issues in as much depth and detail as I would like, obviously, because they are so huge. So you should just take what I say here as an introduction to a much bigger discussion. So, to begin with, Pullman assumes Jesus was only a man. This isn't really such a new idea. Millions of people have made the same assumption. So let's be fair and examine the biblical story of Jesus as if he were only a man. An impartial reading of the New Testament as if Jesus were only a man, I think, can only lead to two possibilities. One, instantaneous belief. Or two, if not belief, then at least enough bewilderment and confusion to accept that belief is the only solution. Initially, I'm not going to focus on the miraculous elements of the story. I'll do that a little bit later. So first, I'm going to look at the more ordinary events. The Jesus of the Gospels is, if anything, not what anyone would expect of a holy man. He spends a lot of time with losers and rejects of society, is accused of drinking and eating too much, speaks words of earth-shattering beauty, preaches a kind of gentleness and humility through words that are just profoundly beautiful, and yet is capable of tremendous rage and also great sorrow. We find a man who violently casts priests out of temples, not what a holy man would normally do, you would think, and he mourns the death of a friend and as well as the state of Jerusalem, so he's profoundly emotional as well. If you had asked a Jewish writer from the time of Jesus to invent the ideal holy man, the writer would have far more likely than not fabricated a more pious and more religious character. But this Jesus plays in the dirt with children and associates with Samaritan outcasts, prostitutes, and tax collectors. And then he doesn't even seem too fussed about keeping the Sabbath. And that was quite a radical idea, because the Sabbath is so central to the Jewish faith. His words are like knives to the self-righteous, and he makes enemies of everyone who apparently stands in the right. But his words are also like a healing balm to the broken and despairing. His message has the clarity of a razor's edge, but the kindness of a down blanket. The history of myth shows that people construct stories of heroes who rise from nowhere and then conquer great enemies, or who die heroic, noble deaths after legendary battles. The heroes of old were armed with physical strength and took enemies by force. And in the 400 years before Jesus arrived on the scene, what the Israelites were expecting was a Messiah who would lead an armed rebellion against the enemies of the Jewish people, just as the Zealots and the Maccabees had tried to do. They were expecting a royal king, one who was born to a powerful family. And so by any measure, the Messiah that Jesus claimed to be didn't quite match up to their expectations. He was dirt poor, homeless at times, well, for much of his ministry he was homeless, an apprentice to a carpenter, not to a rabbi, and a man who formed for much of his life carried the stigma of having been conceived out of wedlock. He was, by any standard measure of what a hero should have been, a bit of a disappointment. To be born in almost utter obscurity and then to die at the hands of the empire that everyone expected him to defeat must have been a tad embarrassing for his disciples at first. And if you were a writer who wanted to convince people that this man that was the Messiah and the incarnation of God, in Jewish Second Temple Judaism, those concepts were actually quite different. One of the things you wouldn't do is leave whole chunks of information out of his biography. The Gnostic Gospels give us a neat fabrication of what the childhood of Jesus might have looked like, with Jesus making small toy sculptures and breathing life into them, so reenacting the creation. Of course, that's a Gnostic idea, not a Christian idea. But the Bible is almost entirely silent about the life of Christ until he was about 30 years old. So there are odd, scattered details, especially about his birth and then an incident when he was 12. But apart from that, there's very little that's been written. Well, nothing, in fact. In addition, what is perhaps the most striking thing about the way that the New Testament Gospels are written on a purely literary front is that they are devoid of any pomp and showy rhetoric. They describe very matter-of-factly the activities of Jesus without trying to manipulate anyone. They tell us that Jesus did this or that or said this or that, and they refuse to elaborate on any of it in very much detail. This fits much better with the idea that the Gospels were written from memory rather than constructed out of pure imagination. For memory is always an essentialized picture. We do not remember details the way that a novelist constructs them. We remember the main ideas and the main events, just like the way that the Gospels report on them. When we read the Gospels, we find again and again that people were stunned at the words of Jesus. They could not get over the authority with which he spoke, and as well as the fact that he seemed to care nothing for the politics of his day. He boldly said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will remain." That's quite a statement. Many of the Jews at the time would not have liked this very much. They wanted a political revolutionary, not a man who claimed to be the Son of God. Very interesting about how ideas of messiahship worked back then. Jesus turns out to be far more offensive and yet far more welcoming than anyone in the first century would have expected. He is recorded to have uttered shockingly iconoclastic words, as if he were politely asking someone at the table to pass the salt. His disciples are reported to have been constantly confused and bewildered by his messages, as much as the Sadducees and Pharisees are recorded to have been horrified by what he was saying. Everyone, and I really mean everyone, if you really closely read the Gospels, didn't know what to make of Jesus at first. He confused them terribly. If Jesus was just a man the way that some people assume he was, no one would have mistaken him for being the Son of God. No one has seen the greatness of Gandhi or Mandela and then has made the claim that they are God incarnate. Throughout history, people have understood the idea of divine representation. From Caesar to the royals in Europe, people have understood that a person may represent God on earth. But it seems like an awfully strange thing to do to suggest that a dirt poor rabbi in an oppressed Israel was actually God himself, not a mere representation. When Jesus said, "Before Abraham was, I am," why did anyone even bother to give him the time of day? Surely they would have simply denounced him as a lunatic. Indeed, there were so many who did try to denounce him, but then there were those who, even though they tried to rule Jesus out, couldn't help but notice that he walked around healing people's physical ailments. This is also quite annoying. Got him into a lot of trouble. Healing people, that's just not on. He turned water into wine, made the blind see, made the lame walk, and then he even brought people back from the dead. That's not something you can easily fake if you've tried it before. Pullman gets around the miracles of Jesus in two ways. He either ignores them because they're a little inconvenient, or tries to explain them as a kind of trick of the mind. Pullman is not the first to do this. Just one example, the American president Thomas Jefferson in 1819 wrote a book called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, which is a reformulation of the original Gospels, but without the perplexing miracles of Jesus. The funny thing is that Jefferson's and Pullman's idea that miracles don't happen should sound perfectly, or would sound perfectly rational to the average person today. But I want to point out something that the average person probably wouldn't be that aware of. It is often thought that miracles are believed by those who have no evidence for them and disbelieved by those who do have evidence. In other words, skepticism proclaims that miracles are believed by irrational people and disbelieved by rational people. That's a very common idea. But the truth is actually the opposite. The disbeliever in miracles is actually the one who has a doctrine or a dogma against the existence of miracles, and therefore cannot, even on the basis of evidence, accept that they happen. This doctrine against the possibility of miracles is founded on a scientific ideal set out by those who follow in the footsteps of the Enlightenment. The ideal can be roughly stated as follows. If an experiment is not repeatable, it is not valid. This is a very good principle to follow in the world of science, and we really should be grateful for it. In medicine, for example, you would actually want a surgeon who follows this sort of principle in his practice. Postmodern medicine, as an alternative, that utterly distrusts absolutes would be absolutely unhelpful and probably a little bit deadly. Ah, but what's a little murder between friends? I certainly don't want a deconstructionist surgeon who would operate on me using a toothpick, a surfboard, and a penguin. That's not on. So my point is not that we should chuck the scientific ideal out of the window. And unfortunately, when people slam modernism or the Enlightenment, often they forget that a lot of it is pretty helpful. The kind of structures we live in, the kind of world we inhabit is based on them. Bless you. So what I'm just trying to say is that we should realize that this principle, this Enlightenment principle, which people tend to base a lot of their reality on, is sometimes not that helpful in other areas of life. For instance, I can use the scientific method for checking if a toaster I have made is reliable. It's a toaster, so no, it isn't. But I cannot use it to analyze why David Copperfield may be a better novel than The Da Vinci Code, or why Kierkegaard makes more sense than Nietzsche. And even if I've created a piece of workable machinery, this toaster that I've now made, it doesn't mean that I need to relegate Shakespeare's Macbeth to a junk heap for being unscientific. The main problem for the legalism of the Enlightenment mindset is that if miracles happen, they're not the sorts of things that can be repeatable in a laboratory. That's why they're called miracles and not ordinaries. Just because something happens that defies a particular God or law of nature that you believe in doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It just means that the laws you thought were impossible to bend or break are not as ironclad in reality as they are in your mind. Basic idea. This brings me to an important idea, which is that it is commonly thought by liberal materialists that they are more open-minded than the average religious nut, like me. But when you look at the core of any oxymoronic materialist philosophy, and materialist philosophy, oxymoronic, you'll find it to be terribly closed-minded, Scratch the surface of a liberal and you will find a conservative underneath. The more I have tested this idea, the more I have found it to be true. So when Pullman writes that people are, and he really does say this, people are, among other things, credulous and thus open to loving mysteries and adoring miracles, he's ignoring much of human history, since people, even religious people, tend to live as if miracles don't happen. All people, no matter what their belief, who accidentally or purposefully fall in front of a moving truck, will expect to meet a sticky end, rather than having an angel whisk them out of harm's way. If Pullman had taken the trouble to actually read the Gospels that he was plagiarizing, he would have noticed a great deal of skepticism, not the kind of willy-nilly credulity that he believes is the norm for religious folks. The central problem with believing or disbelieving in miracles is actually one of rules. The Enlightenment mindset loves rules because they help to make reality predictable and understandable, and therefore completely within the control of the ego or the self. And if you look at behavioral psychology, basic idea there is that people want to make their reality predictable. God doesn't. He doesn't like predictability. He likes surprise and revelation. And these things annoy some people very much. This means that the person who believes in miracles as a rule, like a Christian Scientist, is also bound by the same Enlightenment mindset as the one who doesn't believe in miracles as a rule, like an unchristian scientist. In addition, the usual understanding of miracles as divine intervention usually assumes that God is somewhere very far off and that he steps into the world on the odd occasion to make things a little bit more pleasant than they usually are. And this idea is a Gnostic idea rather than a Christian idea, and it misunderstands what Jesus was really saying when he said, "The kingdom of heaven or kingdom of God is at hand." If we are to understand the Jesus of the Bible, we need to notice that the purpose of miracles was never to prove anything. In fact, whenever people demanded proof of God through miracles, Jesus refrained from performing any. The Enlightenment mindset that demands absolute proof for the existence of God is operating according to rules that neither faith nor reason use to operate. Take the Israelites, for example, who had a pillar of fire and cloud to guide them during the Exodus. Two very obvious signs of God's presence. And yet these people still went off and worshipped an inanimate idol when their leader wasn't around to keep them in check. These miracles didn't keep them believing. Very interesting idea there. And Jesus only ever performed miracles when belief was actually present in some form. He would tell the one healed, "Your faith has made you well." The implication is that miracles are an encouragement or an echo of what is already known or believed. However, there are always those, like some of the Pharisees, who would see the miracles performed and yet would remain unaffected and incredulous. A certain hardness of heart prevented them from actually figuring out what the miracles meant. And that's the point. Miracles were not just things done. They were things that were imbued with meaning. Of course, by hardness of heart, I'm actually talking about egotism. Belief in the possibility of miracles tends to be a step towards acknowledging that you or I and I are not the center of the universe. It's very difficult. We have a kind of geocentric mindset as opposed to a heliocentric mindset, which Copernicus went through a lot of trouble to try and explain was actually the way to go. The point I'm trying to make here is that seeing doesn't automatically result in believing. If anyone is looking for absolute proof, they are living in the wrong reality. And this applies to both science and religion. I've argued at other points that science itself is based on premises of faith. For example, just one of them is that we cannot prove that there is an ordered world outside our minds. That's something we have to assume before we can begin experiments. Believing allows us to see. It's a just reverse of the original idea. This, I guess, is why unbelief is so frequently referred to as spiritual blindness. Pullman not only doesn't believe in miracles, but in fact cannot believe in miracles if he wishes to hold onto his current ideological stance. What's even more ironic, as for anyone who holds to this Enlightenment ideal, is that Pullman, by the same mode of thinking, cannot even believe in the miracle of himself. He is, after all, an experiment that cannot be repeated. He is, like all of us, a freak of nature. The central miracle of that Pullman tries to get around, and this is the big one, is the one at the center of the Christian faith, the resurrection of Jesus. In Pullman's novel, Jesus is taken off to be crucified after being betrayed by his scoundrel brother Christ. That's part of another narrative twist, that the Christ, who is the symbol for organized religion, is the one that betrays Jesus. And after dying, he is then, as is recorded in the scriptures, buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. This is where things get particularly sticky. An unnamed stranger who has been following Pullman's Christ around throughout the narrative steals the body of Jesus from the tomb. Consequently, when Mary Magdalene sees Christ in the garden outside the tomb, she mistakes him for his brother Jesus. And so the rumors spread like crazy. This good man, Jesus, has apparently been raised from the dead. This is a classic substitution illusion made popular in Christopher Nolan's film The Prestige in 2006. It's a great movie if you want to see one. And Christopher Nolan's latest film, Inception, you have got to watch it. One fairly glaring problem with Pullman's premise is that at no point in the rest of the story do people actually notice that Jesus and his brother are in fact twins, and they look alike. I don't know how people got around this. The scoundrel Christ has followed Jesus around everywhere, and at no point in the story do people mistake the one for the other. It's a nice narrative twist, but it doesn't really solve the riddle of why people did claim that Jesus had risen from the dead, and why Christianity took on the form that it did in the first century AD. Pullman's retelling of the resurrection as a magic trick says one thing. Jesus only appeared to rise from the dead, but didn't actually do so. To pull this sort of trick off, the magician requires his audience to be completely in the dark. But this is not really what we find when we take the trouble to read a little history. Pullman assumes, as any indoctrinated modernistic postmodernist would, that people in the first century were terribly naive, and that they would live in the and that those who live in the modern era have progressed beyond such naivety. Through his narrative, he argues that sophisticated people don't believe in such ancient myths and legends and fairy tales. But as far as I can tell, sophisticated people don't take much trouble to research what they're actually writing about. Pullman assumes that people in ancient times were a bit thick and thus implicitly would believe a nonsensical tale about a man who was dead and then came alive again 3 days later. But if anything, the biblical and other historical references reveal a different picture. The biblical account of the Easter story presents us with a twofold hypothesis, namely that Jesus' tomb was empty and that his disciples really did encounter him in ways which convinced them that his resurrection had taken place, meaning that he wasn't just a ghost or hallucination. If the tomb had been empty, but Jesus' disciples hadn't encountered him, they would have assumed, as Pullman does, that his grave had been robbed. This sort of thing happened all the time back then. But if the disciples had only seen an apparition of Jesus, they would have assumed that he had been merely a ghost or hallucination. Because people of that time understood as well as we do now that people in bereavement are prone to such things. So this would not have been a surprise to them if they'd seen an apparition. I'm not going to fall into the Enlightenment trap of trying to prove the resurrection the same way that someone might prove that metal is a better conductor than wood. But to be reasonable, there are a myriad questions that are pretty difficult to answer reasonably apart from the acceptance of this event. I can't look at all of them here, obviously, time, and I'm going to try and highlight at least a few. To understand how an event such as the resurrection of Jesus might be interpreted, it helps to have a look at what the people in the first century thought about life after death. To begin with, the pagan world believed that the road to the underworld went one way only. Death was seen as all-powerful and unconquerable. However, there are two different beliefs regarding what life after death meant. There are those like Homer, and this is just in the pagan world, those like Homer who saw that life after death was a tormented state. And while it would be preferable to return from the dead, this was not possible. Then there were those like Plato who saw the disembodied state of life after death to be preferable to an embodied state. In other words, resurrection would be a step in the wrong direction for Plato. In this world, resurrection meant that the physical body of a human being had been raised, but that such a thing was impossible. Then, within Second Temple Judaism, resurrection, and that was the specific Judaism of the time, resurrection certainly was an idea that people toyed with, but again, there are variations of belief. Some, like the Sadducees, agreed with the pagan view that there was no future embodied life. Others, like the Jewish philosopher Philo, saw the afterlife as being a permanent disembodied state. But apart from these anomalies, most first century Jews believed in an eventual resurrection that would take place when Israel was fully restored. It was an unabashedly political and jingoistic belief. However, that said, this belief wasn't as important in Second Temple Judaism as it became in Christianity. So, when Christianity steps onto the stage of history, there are seven clear and instantaneous modifications to this first century Jewish belief, which must lead any serious reader of history to ask why such a sudden and dramatic change would in fact occur. Firstly, within early Christianity, there is no spectrum of belief concerning life after death. In other words, all the variations and disagreements that were evident in other worldviews suddenly vanish and it becomes really focused. Early Christianity was completely unified in its belief in what resurrection meant. Secondly, resurrection in Second Temple Judaism, as I've already pointed out, isn't that important, but suddenly in Christianity, resurrection moves from the circumference to the center. Thirdly, Second Temple Judaism isn't that specific about what kind of body will be received in resurrection. In early Christianity, however, it is unanimously agreed that the kind of body that is received will be physical, like the present body, and made up of similar material, but transformed into an incorruptible body that is incapable of dying. Then, fourthly, resurrection was always taken to mean an event at the very end of history, but again, quite suddenly, Christians came to refer to two events and not just one. The first event, the resurrection of Jesus, foreshadows the second event, namely the future resurrection of the church. Fifthly, linked to the fourth modification comes the issue of what is termed collaborative eschatology. Resurrection doesn't mean, as it used to in Second Temple Judaism, that when you die, you get to go to heaven one day. Resurrection has implications for the here and now. The early Christians argued that resurrection had begun with Jesus, and therefore God calls those who follow Jesus to implement his work for the kingdom of God through holiness and mission in anticipation of the final resurrection. Sixthly, the metaphorical use of the word resurrection utterly changed with the early Christians. In Ezekiel 37, it is taken to mean the restoration of Israel, but in the New Testament, it is taken metaphorically to refer to baptism, dying and being raised with Christ, and therefore being called to live a transformed life. This sort of conceptual change in understanding doesn't just happen out of thin air and overnight without a very good reason. Then, finally, resurrection was used by the early Christians in an utterly new way to regard how messiahship was seen, as I've already alluded to. No one had predicted that the Messiah would die, and therefore no one expected that he would need to rise again. That was just not predictable. Thus, messianic belief gets utterly rethought around Jesus and his death and consequent resurrection. Bearing the above in mind, and I know it's quite a lot to take in, but I'm just trying to run through some quick ideas here. It's silly to suggest, as some do, that the disciples of Jesus borrowed some ideas from their existing worldview to create a myth that proclaimed the resurrection of Jesus. And of course, Pullman in his novel is trying to suggest that it is a myth, it's just a made-up story. The ideas about the resurrection that were embedded in Second Temple Judaism weren't the ideas that the early Christians propagated. And a unified belief of this kind would not have existed if the ideas had been fabricated. Ancient myths tend to have many variations. If you just read a lot of the ancient Greek myths, you'll find that different storytellers had different versions. In other words, even with the resurrection being a part of Second Temple Judaism, nothing in the culture and religion of the time had predicted the kind of resurrection that the early Christians proclaimed. It was without precedent and remains entirely unique in all of history. Sociologists who examine how ideas shift in culture point out that large cultural shifts happen in degrees over long periods of time. With regard to specific religious beliefs, changes happen even slower because the religious beliefs of a community tend to be preserved by those who wish to honor their tradition. But here, overnight, is a dramatic shift in focus and thinking. Overnight, a completely new religion is born. Comparably, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam, all based within very specific cultures, spread at a snail's pace. But Christianity spread like wildfire and transcended the borderlines of race and culture. This is unprecedented in history. Falling back, as Pullman does, on the claim that Christianity is a fabricated myth doesn't explain this sociological phenomenon. As has always been inevitable, there are those who suggest that the gospel accounts of the resurrection were thought up a while after Jesus and were then modified to include the resurrection narratives. But there are four sound historical reasons for suggesting that this isn't the case. In the first place is what Tom Wright refers to, this is Tom Wright, as this strange silence of the Bible in the resurrection narratives. Throughout the Gospels, there is a great deal of allusion to and quotation of the Old Testament up until the death of Jesus. But regarding Jesus' resurrection, suddenly the stories become entirely bound to standard narrative conventions. Immediately, the theology that has been woven throughout the Gospels is replaced by pure description of events. Secondly, the resurrection accounts never mention the future Christian hope, meaning that the theological implications of the resurrection had not been properly thought through, implying that the Gospel accounts date back to early oral tradition. Instead of appealing to some spiritual experience or vision or theological knowledge, these accounts are entirely rooted in mere history. If you're trying to make up a myth that has a particular point to convince people, this is not something you would do. You would explain what it means immediately, but again, this is not what happened. Then thirdly is the remarkable presence of the women as the first witnesses. In 1 Corinthians 15, written about 15 to 20 years, this is debatable amongst scholars, but it's one of the earliest letters one of the early Christians, Paul's summary of the resurrection account completely disregards the testimony of the woman because at the time, the testimony of women was apologetically embarrassing. The testimony of women would not have been accepted in a court of law. So he just leaves it out. But in all four Gospels, the women are the first reporters, the very first apostles. That leads to an entirely different theological issue. They are at the front and center of this historical event in all four Gospels. If the stories had been made up, the women would not have been there. Such was the chauvinistic nature of that cultural period. To reiterate, if the Gospel writers had wanted to strengthen their argument as much as possible, the women wouldn't have been such an important part of the story. They would have, in fact, been left out. Fourthly, and finally for this little part, just on why we can suggest that these are good gospel accounts or that they're true accounts. The portrait of the resurrected Jesus doesn't fit with any kind of previous example. The expectation, had there been, would have been that the newly embodied Messiah would shine like a star, as recorded through metaphorical language in the book of Daniel. And yet, this is not what we find in the gospel accounts. There are definite signs that his body has been transformed, but not in a way that anyone had expected. It can move through locked doors and is not always recognized. A particularly strange account of this is found in the Gospel of John, chapter 21, where it is recorded that none of the disciples dared ask him who he was because they knew it was the Lord. One has to pause to ask, why would such a confusing innovation arise out of thin air? Yes, as any astute reader of the Gospels will tell you, the resurrection accounts don't line up exactly. In the first place, the Gospels each have a different style and tone. But this is really like comparing two portraits done by two different artists of the same person. One portrait looks like a work of Rembrandt, the other one looks like a work of Holbein, but the person in the portrait is still recognizably the same. Some may suggest then that the portrait we have of the Easter events is biased, but then so is all of ancient history and current contemporary journalism. There is no such thing as a point of view that is without subjectivity, and you can look at basic philosophy of phenomenology to explore this idea. If your reason for throwing out the historicity of the Gospels is bias, then at least do yourself a favor of being just as dismissive of anything that is reported in the Pretoria News or the New York Times. Bias is everywhere, and it doesn't for a moment mean that nothing happened. Then, in the second place, when one compares the resurrection narratives, one finds it difficult to figure out exactly what the details are. It's not clear, for example, how many women went to the grave on Easter Sunday. But as any student of law court witness will tell you, variation in witness is also not a sign that nothing happened, but rather a sign that something did. If, for example, you go through the many eyewitness reports of what happened on September 11, 2001, which, since we're in September, is kind of a month of remembrance, you will find discrepancies all over the place in those witnesses. But I'm sure you wouldn't dare suggest that the whole event was a myth. The unpredictability of historical events means that people generally aren't ready with pen and paper to take notes on what they're witnessing. And while memory and hindsight do have the ability to change minor details of things remembered, the basic facts are difficult to dispute. If, for example, I see a car pileup happen, I may be a little unsure or even confused about exactly how the whole thing happened, but I would be at the very least certain of the basic fact of the wreckages and the car traffic jam in front of me. There are, of course, a number of counter-arguments to the possibility of the resurrection, and I'll just go through a few of them very quickly. Some claim that Jesus was given a drug that made him appear to be dead so that he would only seem to have risen again. As any Roman historian would tell you, Roman soldiers knew how to kill people, and no disciple would have been convinced that a half-beaten-up, drugged-up Jesus had risen and inaugurated the kingdom of God. Some claim that women saw someone else in the garden, and they mistook him for Jesus. This is Pullman's angle, and really people would have figured out sooner or later what was really going on. Some people claim that Jesus appeared only to those who believed in him. This is not actually true. Both Thomas and Paul clearly don't fall into the category of believer. But also, when Jesus was taken away and crucified, none of his disciples believed that he was the Messiah. This is even evident in Pullman's retelling of the resurrection account. Glaringly obvious. This also points out some serious problems with the idea that people in the first century believed in the resurrection because of something called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is the psychological state that occurs when one continues to believe despite strong evidence that refutes that belief. What the disciples of Jesus believed on the occasion of his death was that he had not been the Messiah, that their hopes and dreams were a sham. If there had been any cognitive dissonance, it would have occurred when his disciples discovered that he had actually been raised from the dead. This is exactly what happened to Thomas, who simply could not accept initially what other people claimed to be true. So cognitive dissonance works in reverse, so it's not a very good argument that it didn't happen. Then perhaps the most popular suggestion is that the disciples of Jesus had a kind of spiritual experience that convinced them that Jesus had somehow risen from the dead. This is implausible for a number of reasons. Firstly, the disciples could see and touch Jesus, meaning that he had physical form. And Jesus cooked for and ate with his disciples. And last time I checked, this is not something that spiritual experiences do. Secondly, resurrection was seen by the early Christians in no uncertain terms as the defeat of death, not a more pleasant description of death. Moreover, resurrection doesn't happen at death, but sometime afterwards, which is very different to the Platonic belief of the time. Lastly, spiritual experiences are often preempted by a particular expectation. You can visit a charismaniac church to figure this one out. But here again, we have no such expectation. I'm not slamming charismaniacs. I love them. Okay, this is further strengthened when one notices that there is strong historical evidence that around the time of Jesus there were at least 20 other messianic movements that all ended in the death of their leader. If the culture of the time had produced such naive credulity as skeptics like Pullman claim, why is there only one movement that survived? The other movements dissipated as soon as their messiahs had kicked the bucket. Also, it seems highly unlikely that so many early Christians would be so ready to die for what was only a fairy tale or a myth, especially since it was precisely the resurrection that got most of them into trouble. After all, the resurrection meant that Jesus was Lord and not Caesar, and that Jesus, having defeated death, had actually defeated the last weapon of the tyrant. This brings me back to St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. In chapter 15, he points out that when he had risen from the dead, Jesus appeared to Cephas, then to the 12 disciples, then to 500 others at one time, then to James and all the apostles, as well as to Paul himself. In other words, what Paul challenges his readers to do, if they are doubtful, is to go and chat to these people about what they have seen with their own eyes. What he is writing is this: if you're a little bit fuzzy on the details of what happened, there are lots of people you can speak to who have experienced this in reality. This refers back to what I was saying about those who believe in miracles actually tend to see them. This was a bold challenge that could easily have been taken up, since travel around the Mediterranean was safe and easy, at least for a fair huge chunk of time. Paul couldn't have made this challenge if those eyewitnesses didn't exist. Then, as Tom Wright points out, Jewish tombs, and especially those of martyrs, were venerated and often became shrines. But there is no historical evidence that this happened with the tomb of Jesus. Then the fact that the first day of the week became emphasized by the early Christians is very difficult to explain unless something particularly noteworthy had happened on the first day of the week. A gradual dawning of faith is not sufficient to explain such a redefinition of Sabbath, which was at the center of Jewish tradition and custom. Of course, all of this is just the tip of a very big iceberg. In the postmodern world that is frequently detached from history, it is generally believed that where there is smoke, the fire itself is an illusion. But I think anyone who is seriously trying to figure out what is going on should have the courage to ask where the smoke really comes from. Is all this mirrors and smoke, is it just a magic trick? History seems to indicate otherwise. Sometimes people have misunderstood the fire because the fire isn't as clear-cut as any human-made myth. Again, just on a purely literary level, the Gospels stand completely apart from any literature that had existed before. What Pullman claims, as I have tackled in this and the previous talk, is that the historical picture of Jesus has been turned into a myth by those whose devotion has apparently confused their abilities to reason properly. What I have claimed is that those who, like Pullman, apparently are able to reason properly aren't capable of explaining why Christianity actually started. It's perfectly plausible that people like Pullman don't believe in the claims of Jesus or the miracles of Jesus, but the way that such skeptics tend to attack the claims of the Christian church seems to present simplistic, stereotyped answers that don't really cover the deeper issues of why Christianity took on the shape that it did in the first century. It just reminds me of something that Terry Eagleton says, that postmodernism is allergic to depth. And the more postmodern philosophy I read, the more I find that that is true. Everything gets removed into the realm of ideas instead of rooted in history and context. But apart from the resurrection, it isn't possible to explain why the early Christians went from complete dejection and failure, the failure of their Messiah, to a triumphal proclamation that Jesus was, in fact, who he claimed to be. I've covered only a very small portion of an enormous amount of historical study on the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. What we discover when we take history seriously is so utterly shocking that it remains, even for the believer, difficult to believe. But I want to suggest that the miracles and the resurrection of Jesus uncover for everyone, whether Christian or not, what they actually think about the world that we live in. If a person believes that the world is just a random, dark, cold, impersonal place where all of life is bound to come to nothing but death, then they wouldn't really want to be proven wrong, because that's what the resurrection does, proves them wrong. And I can understand that it may seem to some that faith is just wishful thinking, and I don't think I'd be able to necessarily argue with that. Maybe it is just wishful thinking. It's just that I'm reminded that 4 years ago, almost to the day, I came face to face in my own home with an armed man who, with nothing but terror in his eyes, fired a gun at my own chest from a little over 2 feet away. Both he and I were surprised that I was still standing, and that I was still alive, and that the bullet that should have killed me had ricocheted off something or someone that was standing right in front of me. I know what skepticism looks like from the inside, because I struggled to believe what happened in the very moment that I was experiencing it. When I looked later on at the bullet in the wall opposite where I was standing, I still found it hard to believe what had happened, but there was something I had seen with my own eyes, and here I am, alive, because the God who I love and serve isn't just a myth the way that Pullman thinks he is. Faith may seem like wishful thinking, but the fact that I'm alive and well today has shown me that faith is a flesh and blood reality. I have to admit that I don't live in Pullman's comfortable bubble. I don't think that money and the British bureaucracy have the ability to save anyone, nor the South African bureaucracy for that matter. I don't believe that the world is a safe place, and I certainly don't believe that a person can truly be alive without the Jesus who died and rose again. I've tried to look at some of Pullman's main gripes against the Bible and the church, and while I believe that he is sincere, I can only see that he is ultimately sincerely wrong. I believe with every ounce of me that that Jesus is who he claimed to be, and I really don't care how stupid that makes me look to anyone who believes otherwise. I know that Jesus, through the power of his death and resurrection, is the only hope that this broken world has. Thanks. Yeah, so that was a bit longer than last week. Any thoughts, ideas? Wow, that's a lot of stuff to take in. Yeah, and I don't know if you know of the idea of transference. It's quite a profound idea, but what I think has happened is Pullman's Jesus is really just his own beliefs transferred onto the historical Jesus. So I actually tried to read the story as if I was reading about Pullman and his own brother, which is why I titled the talk "The Good Man Philip and the Scoundrel Pullman," because that's how it feels. He's a bit lost in himself, and so reads the Gospels from that perspective. Very bad hermeneutic practice, but anyway. Anderson?
I hear you when you say that most people are more skeptical than the sort of like caricature we have of people of faith or people of no faith or whatever. The average, your average Joe Soap, who is kind of like just mulls over life and sort of pulls over his own toes kind of thing. And yet there is maybe us here getting up at this time proves that we're totally abnormal. And actually Joe Soap tripping over his toes and only getting to see up a coffee at 8:30 is actually more normal. And now the question is, are those people the very people Pullman is criticizing? That they swallow things whole, or he's not talking about us, he's talking about them.
Oh, there is an us in them? Oh, how disappointing.
But you know what I mean, there is a set of people who are quite happy to swallow whatever leader they like is going to say.
Yeah, the problem, I totally hear what you're saying, and Pullman to some extent is doing that, but he's only criticizing those people who are religious who swallow that, not people like him who are religious but in a different way who swallow things whole. So he is doing that, but he's not critical enough of his own thinking. Again, that is a bit of, all of us are kind of the product of our time, and that is what our time propagates, this idea that we shouldn't critically engage with what we believe, as if intellectualism is something you need to chuck out the window when you have faith. But again, as I've always said, faith is implicit in everyone's existence, whether you are an atheist, a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Christian, doesn't really matter.
So how do we approach people who do not want to think?
In my own teaching, you know this, I do it by confusing people. Confusion is one of the most helpful tools we have in the face of skepticism. Because skepticism means you take things for granted. You assume things. And that means, that's for the Christian as well as the atheist. I tend to be more critical of people in the church than people outside of the church, because people in the church are not generally thinking about what they believe. So, but confusion breaks down idols and causes people to go, whoa, maybe I need to reassess what I'm thinking at this point. That's one way. I don't know if you have any other suggestions. How do you shake people up? How do you get them to question what they believe, apart from confusion?
Well, be willing to hear them out. I mean, what they...
Yeah. Listen properly.
Say, okay, well, now can I tell you...
That's an incredibly important point. I think that... I mentioned this last week, but sometimes the church has tended to just jump to conclusions without really listening to the issues of what people are thinking.
It's usually people don't change. So,
yeah.
I'm going to be like Job, like Jonah. Go throw myself in the sea, because I want paradise for myself. No, nothing about you. When you were speaking now, it just hits me that actually this is not expecting the result.
Yeah.
And it's just like he came, and maybe he came to into the Holy Spirit and then he left. You know, to basically, you know, they had this type of everything and then he's gone, because he's still young. But in the Old Testament, they didn't talk about resurrection, did they?
Well, they mentioned it in passing, just briefly, and the only example I found was really in Ezekiel. And then, again, they may have taken that, as the Sadducees did, as a metaphor. They may have not thought of it literally.
They didn't expect it, and that's why... The
thing that's amazing, Jesus preempted this at every step. He kept on telling them what was going to happen. I will break this temple down, and in 3 days I will build it up again. And they were going, what on earth are you talking about?
Yeah.
We're confused. See, Jesus knew how to confuse people.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm trying to learn from him. Dave?
The woman that wears the proxy in the Old Testament about Jesus coming, because all of those come true, and yet, that's quite a daring thing to say.
It's well. That's one of the things that a lot of skeptics then go, no, but the gospel narratives were they looked at the Old Testament and then reconfigured themselves to fit around the prophecies. Historically speaking, that's not true, because people didn't understand. Looking forwards, we tend not to understand what things mean. Looking backwards, we go, oh my goodness, these things line up perfectly. Which is what I think the Gospels writers actually did. So, but yeah, Pullman doesn't address that at all. It's very inconvenient that these things line up.
What did you say is the reason Pullman wrote the book? Does he have a message he's trying to spread, or was it only to sell books?
Sure. I mean, when you examine any motivation, motivations tend to be very complex. But I think the first one is that Pullman attacked God in his trilogy, which is called the His Dark Materials trilogy. There's a movie made, The Golden Compass, bombed at the box office. It was a terrible flop. But he, in that story, creates a character who is God, who is an old senile man. So he's been attacking God in his other writings in different ways. And so Britain has called him the atheist C.S. Lewis, because, of course, he deals in fantasy. And then Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said, why don't you actually look at the Gospels? And so Pullman then took up the challenge and did this. But I think that a lot of the controversy around Pullman does generate sales very well. I actually think that J.K. Rowling was definitely benefited by all the Christians that slammed her work for being non-Christian. Again, those Christians didn't critically engage with what Harry Potter is about. It's jumping to conclusions because of fear, which is not something that the Bible is about at all. So, I think that's partly an answer. I'm not exactly sure of his motivations, but that would be a fair indication.
Although, one of the things for sure that you've remarked, is also that actually we all want to make Jesus our image.
That's very true.
We're all trying to promote our idea of Jesus, our idea of Savior. You know, Pullman's doing it, we're doing it. We have to guard against that. Just as much as Pullman, just as much as we can throw stones at Pullman, we actually ought to be looking at our own.
I really hope. When I thought of this talk, I thought, would I be able to say this stuff to Philip Pullman? Because it's really easy to speak behind someone else's back. And I thought, well, if I could point out his intellectual failings, he is actually in person quite a reasonable guy. He's not on the new atheist side of the fence. So he's not like that kind of radical fundamentalist in the same way that Dawkins is. He is still a bit more fundamentalist. But I thought of that and I thought, well, but ultimately, I know I'm speaking to largely an audience of Christians, and I'm thinking, how can this transform the way that we look at Jesus and look at the Gospels? Because I think one of the things that I feel is very sadly lacking in the church is a genuine historical engagement. Let's understand the reasonableness of our faith, not that this is just some misty fog of ideas. I think that's really, really important for all of us to have a look at. And I think we've run out of time. Thanks, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. And, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Duncan. Actually, you didn't confuse us.
Oh,
thank you.
Good.